It's a great pleasure to welcome to the conversation Samer Hakura, based in New York. Samer serves as principal of Alfin Capital, which invests in a concentrated portfolio of competitively advantaged public companies with high returns on invested capital and long runways for growth, run by talented and aligned operators focused on long-term compounding. Samer also occasionally looks at special situations. And Samer, it's a great pleasure to have you here. You have a very interesting background that I'd also like to touch on in terms of owning and selling a couple of family businesses and now pursuing value investing in public companies. So if you don't mind just delving a little bit into your background, and we'll take it from there.
John, I'm delighted to be here. You know, over the years, I've derived so much value from MOI, both in terms of hearing well thought out, actionable investment ideas and being able to become good friends and connect with the sort of intelligent, thoughtful value investors you have. And it's a real privilege for me to be able to contribute in a small way back to the community. And so where I come from, so I started off as an investment banker, some two decades ago. Working on about $11 billion worth of M&A transactions and IPOs back in the day when, you know, $11 billion was considered a larger number. And I enjoyed it very much, but I knew I always wanted to be a principal rather than just an agent for deals. So after business school, I went and I joined my father in his family investment office. And he is primarily a real estate investor, and he some time ago helped the Abu Dhabi royal family set up their commercial real estate portfolio in London, and that sort of translated into him doing some of his own real estate investments, and I sort of joined him just as that second phase started to kick off, and I was very privileged to be able to work with him and learn how he approached things. And even though I wasn't familiar with the term value investing at the time, looking back, I can see a lot of what he did meshed in really well with the whole value investing sort of philosophy. So it came fairly naturally to me when I sort of branched out on my own. And other than real estate, one of the investments we made was in a supermarket business in the Turks and Caicos Islands. Through family, friends, and a fairly long, convoluted story, we ended up being owners of this bankrupt supermarket business, which us and two other families, and it turned out to be one of the best investments we made over about 15 or so years, where I was really fortunate to be able to get involved on a very deep level with what turned out to be a local wide moat sort of compounder. And those are things that help me essentially try and replicate in some way when I look at public companies.
Well, that's fascinating. And did you spend time in London or away from New York City at that point?
So I grew up in London. I spent most of my time until business school in London. And it was only after that that I first moved to the Turks and Caicos for about 5 years, and then around 2012, 2013, moved to New York.
Very interesting. Tell us a little bit about the transition from, you know, doing the private side with the family office to now doing public investing. Why did you decide to take that step? And have you found that some of the things you learned along the way are now transferable to the public markets?
So, when we sold the business in 2013, my personal story is I went and I looked at trying to buy private, lower middle market private companies in the US. I moved here for sort of personal reasons and love it here. And what I found out was when you're trying to do private deals in, what you have to do is pick a couple of industry sectors and go really deep into those, network in those sectors, spend, you know, anywhere from a year to 5 years really getting to know people involved in those sectors. And I really approached things very much as a generalist. And what I found was while I was looking for private deals to do, I started deploying my own personal capital into the markets to try and earn a return while waiting for the deal. And I can't tell you exactly when, but at some point I hit that inflection point where I said, you know what? I'm practically spending most of my time investing in public market securities at this point. Why don't I make a full-time job of that? And I haven't looked back since.
Interesting. And
in terms of your sort of question, look, there's a lot of parallels, I think. I mean, the way I approach things is business is business. Whether you're buying a public company, whether you're buying a private company, you know, that famous quote about it's not just numbers flicking about on a screen. Behind it, there are real people doing real business, I think is very applicable. And, you know, there are some constraints in terms of when you're buying a private business, you know, unless you're a very large fund, you typically tend to look at things one thing at a time, and you buy the majority or the entirety of a business. When you're buying a public company, obviously, you're most of the time buying a fractional ownership. And so you get the opportunity to spread your bets a lot more. I mean, I run a fairly concentrated portfolio, about 15 to 20 positions. But compared to the private markets, that's still much more diversified.
Summer, do you have any preferences in terms of the industries or any focus, especially perhaps in light of the public or the private experience that included some real estate investing? Have you used that experience in the public side as well? Or are you really looking for the more capital light compounder businesses?
I tend to find myself these days looking much more at the capital light compounder businesses. The general admonition to make sure you understand what it is you're looking at, staying in your circle of competence, I think is very important. But beyond that, I take a pretty open approach towards industry. You know, I haven't found myself doing too much in real estate. I won't do stuff in biotech, for example. But if you look at the things I invest in at the moment, they tend to be, unsurprisingly, given my background, family holding companies with what I think are, you know, compelling valuations and multiple levers to pull because they have what you would call a synthetic leverage, things like float and various other things. And on the other hand, I also look at a few smaller cap cloud-based capital light businesses where I think the opportunity for growth is tremendous, especially if you can buy them before they're widely known and when their valuations are not aggressive.
And this is now your sole focus, is that right? Or are you still doing some things on the private side as well?
You know, I have a directorship at a small company that my brother's now running quite well. And other than that, no, I'm totally focused on this. In fact, I'm in the process of establishing a sort of managed accounts where the goal is to take on other entrepreneurs or families who might think they could benefit from some, you know, help and guidance with where to put their money and how to invest it in the equity markets.
You mentioned family-controlled holding companies. Is this on a global scale? And then how do you kind of go through the process of evaluating a family that's a majority owner and judging whether they're going to be the right stewards of capital going forward?
So I'll tell you about one of my favorite current positions, something where I have tremendous respect for the person heading it, and where I think I'll be able to hold on to this company for many years as they compound value, and that's John Elkann and Exor, and widely known, widely respected. When you think in terms of someone who has a sort of deep understanding of the business and who really cares about safeguarding his family legacy, yet who's bold enough to do transformational deals to bring this, what used to be a sort of old school conglomerate, into the modern world, I think riding alongside someone like John Elkann is should be a pretty good thing to be able to do. If you read his letters to shareholders and the thoughtful interviews he gives, it's very clear that this is someone who would like to take his family company and see it last another 100 years and continue to prosper. And that's the type of situation I like to be involved with if I can. If you add on to that the fact that it's just from a valuation point of view, in my view, it has a double discount. So it's trading at a significant, call it 30-something percent to the sum of its parts. And its parts themselves, I believe, are extremely undervalued. You're in a very fortunate position to be able to join in with Mr. Elkann at a very undemanding valuation. And then if you look at some of the other things he's done, like effectively copy the Berkshire model by buying an insurance company and generating float, and then assembling a really high-level, high-caliber advisory council with people like the former Chancellor of the Exchequer of the UK and Jorge Lehmann from 3G Capital and Rob Spear from Tishman Spear and various other impressive people whose job is basically to help advise him buy companies at a discount, probably when there's the next market dislocation. I get very encouraged by the potential for the company. So that's just one example of the type of thing I like to do.
Very interesting. Well, if we can stay with that for just a moment, obviously, Exor, a large portion of the value currently seems to be the fiat holding. How do you go about assessing that kind of major investment? Do you actually need to be comfortable to invest in fiat? And then you just say, well, it's even better to invest in Exor. And do you look forward maybe several years to where fiat might be a smaller portion of the overall portfolio?
I think you just took the words right out of my mouth, John. That's exactly right. I was pretty fortunate in sort of 2007, early part of 2008, to be a shareholder of fiat itself. I love situations where you've got an incredibly strong management team who, instead of giving you quarterly guidance necessarily, say, you know, this is our five-year plan. And they go into a huge amount of detail about their plan, sort of based off the strength of some of their brands like Ram and Jeep, and the success they've been having with some of their vehicles and platforms. And they say, you know, when I got involved with the business, in round numbers, it was a, call it 18 billion euro market capitalization company with about 10 billion in debt. And the company said, you know what, within a fairly short period of time, we're going to pay down the vast majority of that debt. And I don't think you need to build a complicated model to realize that's going to generate huge amounts of value for the equity shareholders. And they, with very minor missteps, did what they said they were going to do. And I, this was one of those few times where I actually timed my exit near the top, and that was more due to luck than anything else. And then as I sat down and said, you know, what do I do with that bit of capital I was fortunate to have made, discussing the situation with some friends of mine who are experienced and wise, they suggested I look at Exor, the parent company, in more detail. And then I realized, well, I like what they're doing. And then I probably, hopefully, won't have to make this sort of sell decision, which is always a difficult decision, if I just hold the parent company. So, you know, I'm quite familiar with Fiat because of my previous holding. And I think what Mr. Elkin's likely to do, although of course I can't know this, is he will find a way, whether it's through the current deals that are being spoken about with Renault or some other way, of merging the company and then potentially taking those cash flows or the cash from selling it and redeploying that into capital light compounders.
Speaking of capital light, you also mentioned that you look at companies in the cloud or with a kind of recurring revenue business models that don't require capital to grow. Could you give us an example, perhaps, of the kind of company that would attract you in that space?
So I'm actually looking at a much smaller company right now, where the advantage of where I sit, not managing, you know, very large sums of money, is that I can look across sort of industries, I can look across capital structures, and I can look across market capitalizations and try and find value wherever it may lie. So I like having a significant amount of my money in the Exors of the world, where I feel fairly safe. And I think it's not a bad idea for someone in my position to also see if I can find companies that are much smaller, where I believe there's an opportunity for real sort of growth and value generation. Like a lot of people, I've long admired companies like Constellation Software or Roper Technologies or OpenText. These are companies that, similar to the situation I had with my private company, but of course on a much larger scale, companies that generated large amounts of free cash flow and then redeployed that cash flow into acquiring other businesses at high rates of invested capital, and then using those expanded cash flows to go and buy some more companies and sort of keep sort of accelerating that process. And those companies are fairly well studied and have done incredibly well over the last few decades. And there's a much smaller company at the moment called Quarterhill that I'm looking at that is unproven. And it's a sort of mini version of those larger companies. In fact, the CEO came from OpenText, where he was formerly head of business development, and he oversaw a deployment of $2.5 billion of capital into acquisitions and integrations. So he seems to have the right background to do this. And what I like about it is Quarterhill has a legacy business that's a patent litigation business. Very cash flow generative, but highly irregular. And if there's one thing we know, it's the market strongly dislikes irregular cash flows, and the stock's been punished. But if you look at this instead of as an easy to model business, as the sell side typically looks for, but instead of view this business as a source of recurring cash flows for acquisitions, and you pair that with a CEO who's done this sort of thing before, I think there's huge optionality in the name. And I think one benefits from the, you know, the Monish Pabrai famous quote about heads I win, tails I don't lose much, where I think he's got the opportunity, or investors have the opportunity to buy into this company at a very cheap valuation. Should the CEO affect a large acquisition with those cash flows, I think the company will do very well. Should he not do that, well, the company's sitting on a very large cash balance, which could be a dividend that did back out to shareholders, or there are other ways to realize value where even if he doesn't succeed, you're probably not going to lose much money at all. And then there's a few other things, intricacies with the stock that I could go into if you really wanted, but
maybe just if you would elaborate a little bit on how you would think about valuing a company like this. It sounds like there's a balance sheet component where there's some asset value there. And then how do you think about perhaps the value of the legacy business versus what might come in the future?
No, great question. So I, as a matter of principle, shy away from building complicated models. When I was an investment banker, it was my job. And one of the things I learned was that a model tell you whatever it is you ask it to tell you, depending on the inputs you put. So I like things to be obvious and simple. And that's something I sort of learned the hard way. Very simply here, this is a company with, in round numbers, a market capitalization of about $125 million with $70 million in cash. So an enterprise value for around $55 million. The legacy business has generated EBITDA of around $400 million cumulatively over the last 10 years. So on average, $40 million a year. Very variable. Free cash flow has been slightly lower than that, but it's generated huge amounts of cash flow relative to its size. And management highlights the fact that they've dividended out and done buybacks cumulatively about $135 million over the last 10 years. So those are fairly large numbers as compared to a $55 million enterprise value. So I'm not too worried about the downside in terms of value. Of course, should things not work out, you know, the market can and will be very volatile, but I think the risk of permanent capital impairment is fairly low. So that's on the downside. On the upside, when you're, you know, got a $55 million enterprise value and you've got $70 million in cash to deploy into an acquisition, I think, and you have a CEO who has the right background and really speaks very articulately about his plan, which seems very sensible, I think it's just a matter of time until he finds an acquisition to do. And should it be a large transformative acquisition, you're probably going to see a large amount of value being created. Should it be a smaller bolt-on type acquisition, you'll probably see a smaller market reaction. But in either case, the strategy will have begun, and provided the CEO maintains this strategy, you know, you have a chance of, through this buying it at such a cheap price, sort of legging into a potential compounder for not very much money at all.
Very interesting. Summer, maybe we can shift gears a little bit. I'd be curious just to hear about your own personal journey and how you see that evolving going forward. It sounds like you are perhaps looking to build an investment business as well. And given your background as an entrepreneur and looking at private businesses, I can tell you sometimes I myself, when I invest, there's really not that much to do. And if you invest for the long term, it feels like, you know, you find a couple of good ideas per year or something like that. So tell us a little bit about how you, with that entrepreneurial mindset, are looking to investing as being a kind of the main thing going forward for you.
You know, it's interesting you say that part about sometimes there's not all that much to do. When I was working directly with my father, he made an investment in a what turned out to be a wonderful business in a great location on New Bond Street in London. And it was supported by an anchor tenant, which was Ralph Lauren, which was a strong tenant for us. And he sat on that building for the better part, I think, of 18 years. And the building sort of, you know, compounded in value in round numbers, 20% a year for that amount of time. So there was a lot of work done with just managing the building and making sure it was run properly. But there wasn't a huge amount of activity being done in terms of sourcing all that many new deals for a period of time. And, you know, we sat through 2008 and a few other sort of, you know, turbulent times where, you know, I remember having a conversation with my father and he'd just say, you know what, there's a time to buy and there's a time to do nothing. And that time to do nothing could be 6 months, it could be 3 years. But we just sit on the asset we have and wait for that to happen. So, yeah, it's one thing to read about these things through other investors. It's another thing, I believe, to live through an experience like that and say, you know what, if it worked with that asset, let me try and replicate that approach to the public markets. And so what I'm trying to do with my business is, you know, having seen a little bit about managing a compounding asset successfully, I'm happy to talk about the supermarket business in a bit more detail, and how we affected sort of growth in that business, and given a little bit of, you know, capital markets sort of background, given my investment banking background, I'm sort of trying to synthesize all of that into a, you know, portfolio company where I, you know, manage the majority of my own personal money, and should, you know, family offices or high net worth individuals or others decide to come along for the ride, it would be my privilege to go on that journey with them.
And maybe we can actually spend a few minutes on that food retail business you mentioned in the Turks and Caicos. I think that's a fascinating experience you had there. If you wouldn't mind sharing some lessons you took away from that.
So we bought it when it was a bankrupt business sitting on about 64 acres of land. I think you're in a smaller country in the Caribbean, with a, you know, smaller sort of population. I think the previous owners potentially overbuilt it relative to the side of support the market would support. So my father and his colleagues managed to buy it at sort of bankruptcy prices. You know, in the first year it sort of lost money, the second year it broke even, and then it sort of proceeded to compound in the 30-odd% range for a good 15 years. And what I noticed was the first thing we did was we hired a really good hands-on manager who solved the logistics of getting fresh produce onto the island in a sort of economical and expeditious manner. So what that meant is, instead of, you know, your lettuce sitting in container ships for a few weeks and wilting, we managed to get fresh produce onto the shelves. Once you did that and you have the better product, of course that attracted customers. Once that attracts more customers, of course, you know, your sales and your cash flows sort of ramp up fairly quickly. And then what we did after that was we used those increasing cash flows to reinvest back into the business, continue to expand the business, expand locations, hire more people, improve systems and processes and upgrade those. And sort of one thing kind of leads to another where, you know, you keep doing this for a few years and you find yourself being the 80% sort of, having 80% of the market, and albeit in the smaller market. But then you have this wonderful moat of economies of scale where, because you're a large employer in the local market and you're the biggest purchaser of food in the local market and you're one of the biggest users of the transportation system in the local market, you get access to better prices, better economies, and you can produce or you can deliver higher quality products at better prices to your customers. And once you've set yourself up in that, it's a classic moat. It's very hard to dislodge. And then in addition, and this goes back to when I was talking about why I was very attracted to the constellations and the OpenTex and the Quarter Hills of this world, albeit those, of course, are much, much larger businesses, but we started generating large amounts of cash flow, and we started deploying that cash flow into building up a central commercial hub in the middle of the main island there, where we started to develop those 64 acres of land. We built a community, a sort of townhouse village, 7 or 8 commercial buildings. And it is one of those things where the whole became greater than the sum of its parts, where we had the supermarket, as you can call it, the anchor tenant for the entire location, but we built up this entire community there. And that, when we came to sell the business some years later, added tremendous amounts of value to the whole.
Can you talk a little bit about idea generation? I'm really curious how those kinds of opportunities come your way, or how you would find them, perhaps specifically on the investment you made in the Turks and Caicos. And then also, more relevant to today, how you go about finding opportunities in the public markets, such as Quarter Hill.
I think the opportunity in the Turks and Caicos, we were fortunate. It was through friends of friends of family connections. I think it was my mother's uncle was good friends with the father of my father's eventual business partner. It's one of these convoluted family stories. So I think that just was down to luck. But in terms of how I sort of find opportunities in the public markets, I think that's there's a bit more of a process there. Look, I think we're in the internet age today, and I think ideas are some people may disagree with me, but I think ideas are not the difficult part. I think there are a number of very high quality ideas that come out several times a year through your platform. I think it behooves an investor to listen to those and, get a couple of tidbits from that, as I've done in the past. If you're looking for capital light or high return invested capital compounders, it's fairly easy with today's tools to screen for them. One of the best sources of ideas I find is, we've generating a network of highly intelligent and able investor friends who you can potentially share ideas with. And that leads to some very high quality ideas. One of the advantages, I think, of investing in the public markets versus in the private markets was, in the private markets, information is much harder to come by, and it's a lot more competitive. Either you buy this company or I buy it. Whereas in the public markets, I can buy, fractional ownership in a large company, and you can as well. And we both benefit. So there's a lot more sharing of ideas. So the idea generation, I think, is pretty standard, and there's a lot of there's a lot of quarterly letters from investors, there's a lot of blogs, all that sort of thing. I think what becomes more important is the process of rapid elimination of this sort of deluge of ideas into a more manageable list of higher potential names that one can look for. And I think that's where kind of having a bit of experience of running a business or knowing what you like can help you do that. So in my case, well-run family offices, public family holding companies, I think is a great source of interest to me. seeing a presentation on a company that has generated higher returns on invested capital for many years and is priced, you know, fairly in a fairly undemanding way, and you know, my sort of focus, I focus on that pretty quickly. And then I think it's, you know, once you manage that list down from this huge deluge of ideas to more manageable lists, it's a matter of just going through them all one by one. Can be painstaking in some cases to find stuff that you like. And a lot of the times it's, oh, you know, this was interesting to learn, but, you know, I'm not paying, you know, 30 times EBITDA or whatever it may be. I'll wait for the market to give me a better price, if ever. And I find that maintaining a constantly evolving watch list of companies is incredibly useful, because it means that should prices come down to a more reasonable level, I can act fairly decisively and quickly because I've already done the work on the name. And it also helps keep one focused on higher quality ideas that one likes versus sort of straying into, you know, uncharted waters and potentially making a mistake.
And perhaps lastly, I'm curious how you think about holding cash and whether top-down considerations have any bearing on the portfolio. Do you consider where we might be in the market cycle or market valuations when you're deciding how much to allocate to the equities in your portfolio?
You know, that's a great question, and it's one I spend quite a bit of time thinking about, and it's not one I have a, you know, cookie cutter formulaic answer to. You know, I'm not as a lot of value investors would say, I'm not a global macro specialist, and you know, if you just look at what's happened over the last 6 months or so, I think, you know, just one series of data points, but it shows you how difficult it is to know where you are in the market and what's going to happen tomorrow. You know, it's a combination of buying stuff I really like, sort of a sort of micro bottom up view. If I see a company I really like and I believe I understand and I think it's got a potential compounder and the price is attractive to me, I'll probably buy it. I may not buy everything in one go. I might sort of scale into the position over a few months just to become more familiar and you know, see how the price develops. So I'll usually approach it that way. And I find that, you know, if the market's nearer a top than a bottom, well, valuations typically tend to be higher. So you end up being, you know, holding more cash anyway, just because you haven't found anything to buy as much at the right price. You know, I read the news like everyone else, you know, and I'm sort of cautious, but I don't believe in my sort of global macro skills enough to come out with a sort of definitive view of where we are in the market. There is something to be said, of course, of having some cash to give you the opportunity to buy things you like as and when the market presents opportunities. I've been doing this long enough to have seen that, you know, when you least expect it, you know, you every now and again just, you know, you get a tremendous opportunity to buy something wonderful, and you know, it would be a shame not to have spare cash to be able to take advantage of that opportunity. So that tends to be my approach. I'm sorry if it's not like a simple formula, but those are some of the nuances I think about.
Wonderful. Well, this has been very educational, very interesting for me to kind of learn from somebody who has had the private background investing and actually being involved with actual operating businesses and now value investing in public companies. So thank you so much, Samer, for being here and taking the time to share your perspective.
It's my great pleasure, John. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Goodbye for now.